Today's show is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, sharing nothing but the best in whole grain nutrition and committed to their mission of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. Charlie and I are in studio looking deep into each other's eyes, really situating kind of post, little vacay for
connecting.
You, a little bit of sleepy morning for me. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report. I am one of your hosts, Erin Fairbanks.
And I'm Charlie Comer.
And we have a jam-packed show today, so let's get into it.
Absolutely. Well, we're really excited to be joined on the phone today by Greg Wade and Will Travis. Greg is the head baker at Publican Quality Bread in Chicago. He collaborates with chefs, farmers, retailers, and all sorts of people in the agricultural community to develop breads using heritage grain varieties and traditional fermentation techniques. And Will is an eighth-generation farmer at Spence Farm in Fairbury, Illinois. And there he grows with his father, Marty, and his wife, Chris. They raise a large variety of products. They raise fruits, vegetables, Dexter cattle, and small grains. And since 2003, they've been marketing directly to restaurants a large variety of specialty grains. So thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
I have to say, I'm like eighth generation and in Illinois. You must be part of a pretty small club.
there's a couple of us around here. There's one about an hour south that they got, I think they settled their farm 2 years before us.
Wow. Wow. What year is that? I mean, just for people who don't do math very well.
Our farm was settled in 1830, November of
1830. Wow. Damn. Kudos to you.
Well, we're really excited to hear about your collaboration and how the culinary industry and farming can work together in promoting biodiversity and grains. And we'd love to hear a little bit more about your background and how you guys got started. So, Greg, maybe you could start out telling us about your breads.
Well, at Publican Quality Bread here, we focus on natural fermentation and obviously local farms, whole grains, featuring most of our grains from Spence Farms. Most of our breads see a 60-hour fermentation. You get a whole ton of good benefits out of that. First and foremost, it's really tasty. You get a lot of organic acid development and things like that from a long fermentation like that. And then on top of that, it's actually really a healthy process. You know, you're getting a lot of starch breakdown. You're getting a lot of protein breakdown. You're getting some enzyme activity, which allows you to actually absorb all of the nutrients in a food product. Which is pretty unique from the sourdough starter, and really the kind of the natural sourcing of our ingredients also plays into the health benefits of it. So we can kind of get this into this a little bit later, but the heritage varieties of wheat that we use and the farming practices that Will uses is much healthier for us as people, and doesn't have any like chemicals or nasty stuff on it, so it's really kind of a much more natural process that's actually healthy for you.
So, all right, so I'm sold, but why? So, why is everyone not making bread like this? What's the reason that this isn't kind of all the bread we eat?
Well, it takes a lot of time. You know, 60 hours is a fair amount of time to devote to making a loaf of bread, don't you think?
Yes.
You know, I think that time is a big factor of it, and it's, I think, just a little bit intimidating for people to, you know, take care of a sourdough starter and to devote that amount of time to it and just really practice the craft. You know, like everyone's first loaf of bread is almost inevitably, you know, flat and doesn't taste very good, and it's just a hard process to kind of get the inner workings of right away. So I think that it's just kind of daunting for people. As far as why it's not a large-scale bakery operation, the dough that we use, or the dough that we make, really does not work well with mechanization. So we don't, like, you know, we don't use baguette formers, we don't use divider rounders or anything like that. Everything is hand-shaped, and that's a really labor-intensive process. So for these bakeries that are mass-producing sandwich pan loaves and things like that for butternut or, you know, bunny bread or whatever it is, that all is just mostly machines. So it's really not effective for a large-scale bakery operation. You know, you have to have it big enough that it's successful, but small enough that it's that you're able to still do everything by hand.
Yeah, I had a girlfriend who was a new friend of mine, and I didn't know her that well. I was like, do you have kids? Do you have any animals? And she's like, I have a Levon. I was like, it was so out of context. It like took me a minute. I'm like, like the starter? She's like, what? You got to feed it every couple of days, take care of it. I think too, thinking about like a 60 hour fermentation, just also kind of space, you know, space to like hold, just like literally let the bread dough chill.
Right.
Awesome.
Well, and so I guess we'll ask the same question of Will. We want to hear a little bit more about the varieties of grain that you're growing and how you've found them and developed them, and why isn't everybody growing these varieties?
So a few years ago, we got started. We had just been doing some winter soft red winter wheat varieties, just nothing special really, because that's mainly what's grown in this area is the soft red winter wheat, and it doesn't work quite so well with the bread programs, and we started working with Greg a little bit and looking into what might work better with the bread programs, and it seemed like the hard wheats, spring wheats, would be better, and, you know, everyone around here is like, well, you can't grow spring wheat in Illinois. Well, we've been doing it for probably, 5-8 years now, Greg, and
yeah,
seems to be working pretty well for us. So we've got probably 2 or 3 different varieties of spring wheats that we do, and we also do a few varieties of winter wheat, as well as a rye, some sorghum, millet, oats, and a few, probably 3 or 4 different varieties of corn that we do as well.
So it's a real mix. One of the things I think is interesting when you think about making bread, obviously you have very few kind of ingredients, right? You have your yeast or your starter culture, water, flour, and then maybe some, you know, maybe a little something else. But one of the things that I feel like people really think about flour as being kind of this inert substance that is kind of a blank slate. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit, Greg, about working with these flours and kind of dealing with something that is alive, whereas the baker, you're really looking to show the grain versus kind of force your will over the grain.
Right. Well, so that's one of the things that I absolutely fell in love with starting to work with these heritage varieties of grain is that, and working with Will, is that we were able to select varieties not only for what works on the farm, but what works in the bakery. And what I'm most interested in is not only like baking quality and how, you know, light and fluffy and things like that we can make the bread, but also flavor. You know, all these modern variety of wheats that are grown on factory farms are grown for yield and for ease of harvest and things like that. And flavor is the bottom of the list, or even if it's talked about at all. So for us, you know, picking something that actually tastes good is pretty much top of the list, and then also making sure that it works for the farm. And one thing that we really noticed when we started making bread out of these things is that one thing I like to do is we'll take the whole milled grains and mix them just with water, usually equal parts flour by water by weight, and we We just let that sit overnight, and then the grains that we got from the farm always start fermenting naturally over that, you know, 18-hour, 24-hour process. And you can smell it. You know, it's really aromatic. It's really nutty. It's really kind of spicy sometimes with the rye. And you can do the same thing with a commercial commodity store-bought grain, and it is flavorless and lifeless, and it just kind of smells like cardboard. So, thank you. It was just kind of remarkable when we first started doing that. You're like, wow, these things can actually have life to them.
Right. Well, I wonder, you know, we are really lucky here in the Northeast, especially when it comes to grain. Grow NYC, which runs the Green Market System and some other environmental programs here in New York City, has really focused on our kind of regional grain shed for the last couple of years. A lot of that work really stewarded by a woman named June Russell. And one of the interesting things about June's work is, you know, how many people are involved in, I'm going to use the word grain economy, because you have the growers and the millers and the distributors and the malters, because a lot of it goes into beverages. And then, you know, people on your end, Greg, who are baking with the flour and baking with the grains and figuring out kind of what's the best application for different things. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit, I'd love to hear from each of you actually, on what is the kind of infrastructure right now in your area to support this type of work? Are you feeling like this is a movement that's picking up steam and there are more people coming into the space? And like, what's it going to ideally look like over the next couple of years? Well, maybe we'll start with you because, you know, you're closer to the beginning.
Yeah. What we see is there is becoming more of a movement toward growing the small grains, and it's an easy way for the big conventional farmers to transition into doing either organic or transitional organic, or just heading towards the food market itself and getting out of doing the corn and soybeans. It's a lot easier transitioning to doing small grains than it is to doing, you know, 100 acres of tomatoes or something like that. They've already got the equipment to be able to do it. We also have we have about an hour from us a commercial mill being built, and it will be, though we work with them quite a lot, and they'll be milling transitional organic and organic grains in there as well.
I think that's still supposed to be a stone mill though, right? Well, not a roller.
They have it'll be a stone mill. It's a kind of stone mill, I guess. It's not really a granite stone or whatever, but it's kind of like a composite. But they're going to be set up to do, you know, large quantities. When, you know, you look at us and we can mill maybe 200 pounds an hour, and they can mill 200 pounds in 5 or 10 minutes. So.
How has your farming community gotten to the scale, you know, where there's enough grain to go through a mill like that? And what was initially, you know, you've been doing this since 2003. What was the reception of your farming neighbors when you first started doing some of, I know on your site you say that you farm in wild and weird ways, so.
Yeah, when we first got started, actually, you know, we really didn't start getting into the grains until probably, it might be 10 years ago now, but when we first got started, it was mainly into wild harvested stuff out of our timber and our cousin's timber, and then in doing produce. And, you know, we're good friends with a lot of our surrounding neighbors and everything, and everyone thought, well, that's a lot of work. I don't want to do that, but more power to you guys for doing it. So, and there was quite a lot of buy-in in the very beginning from the grocery store in town, too. They wanted to have product from us and the other farms that we were working with in the store there, and there was a lot of buy-in from the community to buy that stuff as well. And it's we've kind of recharged that in the last year or two, and it's growing again here in the local community of actually selling stuff in the grocery store again. But I'd say that the local, you know, our neighbors and everyone around us, it's still, you know, they think it's interesting, and there are a few that are transitioning to do this type of stuff of the big guys. There's a lot more small families getting into it than there is the big conventional farmers. We do have a few conventional farmers that are switching over, but generally a lot of them just think, man, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, well, I think there's like something kind of exciting about, you know, proving the market. And especially in the U.S., when you really think about the bulk of what we're growing, I mean, it is in the grain space. You're looking at the soy and corn and wheat. And I think we got kind of deal with the realities of most of the food, most of the calories we're producing are in that space. So I think it's nice to see some of this activity happening in like small ways and reaching like tentacles out to just say like, hey, you know, there's some other options or a space if you're interested in even, you know, transitioning a smaller parcel of your land.
Right.
Have you been involved at all in seed exchanges or variety development?
There's a group that the small farm educator with the University of Illinois Extension, he started. Called the Grand Prairie Grain Guild here, and we have done a few seed trials with him for some different corns and some different wheats, but he's got, his name is Bill Davison, he's got a huge group of people in the area here throughout central Illinois and even throughout the Midwest here that are doing seed trials all over probably a couple hundred different varieties of stuff that I would imagine.
Wow. Greg, on the kind of consumer facing side, I mean, you know, you've talked about the process that you're using to make the breads, which it involves a lot of like, you know, time, but also like, you know, essentially like manpower, hand shaping the loaves. How do you kind of translate that value to your customers? I mean, especially I think too, when people are kind of used to bread costing, you know, a couple of bucks. I mean, I guess yours goes for a little bit more. But that kind of story around why we should be paying more for better bread.
Well, I think that, you know, to relate to that, all you really got to do is tell the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you tell the story of Will down on the farm, and you know, him and his family have to be successful, and then you've got. Actually, we're lucky enough to have him milling and delivering as well, so we're able to keep the cost down a little bit that way. Because you know, if you were to send it to, you know, a commercial mill or something like that, then he's got a value-added step and he's got to make money, and then you've got to go to the distributor and then he's got to make money. But really, just you know, you tell the story. You know, you tell the story of this is you know, a heritage-raised grain. A lot goes into it. There's tons of work prepping the fields each year, and, you know, you're subsequently trying to, like, plan your crop rotations and making sure that your soils are healthy and things like that. And then really just the time and the care that we all take all across the way between Will on the farm and then us at the bakery. You just tell that story, and most people are really receptive to it. We're not prohibitively expensive, I don't think. But we just want to make sure that everyone knows the value of all of the hard work that all of us are doing.
Of course, it tastes good, too.
it helps that it tastes great.
Well, that's a great reminder, too, speaking of telling your story, that there's a recently released documentary about your work called Sustainable, and it was just released on Netflix, and it can also, there's a site for it, sustainablefoodfilm.com. So, we really appreciate Will and Greg, you taking time to speak to us today and tell your story. And we hope our listeners will go ahead and watch this film on, so they can learn more.
A little sustainable Netflix and chill.
Yeah.
Guys, thanks so much. We are going to take a short break, and we have another guest coming back for the second half of the show. So stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Bye. Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts of the seed, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The endosperm is the main energy storage unit of the seed. That's where the growing plant gets its energy before it can start photosynthesizing and making its own. It makes up a huge portion of the grain, about 83%, and it's the main source that's used for white flour. When you make white flour, you get rid of the germ and the bran and just have the white endosperm left. It contains almost all the carbohydrates. It also contains protein and iron and some of the other B vitamins as well. It's kind of what you classically think of when you're thinking of flour. So all that's there when you're milling with whole grains. But when you mill with whole grains, you also get the bran, which is the kind of roughage and gives that, that's what gives that kind of color to it. Also gives you extra fiber that helps you to be regular. And you also get the germ, which adds the fat and the flavor, which we all like from whole grains. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
So I guess we're coming back. Charlie and I are like not up on the transitions today, but guys, bear with us because we have more good fermenty talk.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We're moving from grain to grapes, and we're very excited to be joined in the studio by Chad Hendrickson. Chad is from Lakewood Vineyards in beautiful Watkins Glen, New York, on Seneca Lake. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, everybody.
I feel like those, like, what the Western New York names sometimes give you, like, a little bit of a run for your money.
Well, Chad, could you tell us some about Lakewood?
Yeah, sure. Lakewood Vineyards, we have been a winery since 1988. We've been growing grapes in the area for 53 years, so they're a pretty established winery.
We only interview people here who've been farming since the 1800s.
Yes, it's a new rule. 2017.
We are a moderately sized winery, but we're not too big. We're not too small. I think we're positioned right for the area. We produce around 45,000 cases of wine a year. We produce both vinifera, i.e., European grapes, and native grapes to the area, Labrusca grapes. And hybrid grapes all into wine. So our main wines are Riesling. We produce four different distinct styles of Riesling, Cabernet Franc, Pinot Noir. But then we make some sweeter wines as well that really appeal to a pretty broad market. So we're excited to help out on both ends there. So
that's great. Well, it's March, but it's a sunny day here in Brooklyn, so I guess we're starting to think about getting out of the city. Some folks are probably thinking about summer and traveling and making some visits. So could you tell us a little bit more about either just the region, visiting vineyards in the Finger Lakes, or any events you guys do?
Yeah, sure. You know, the Finger Lakes is actually a series of lakes. It's 11 lakes total. For the wine region, there's three main lakes. There's Keuka, Seneca, and Cayuga, starting west, going east. Seneca is probably the lake that has the largest amount of wineries. It's the deepest of the lakes. Cayuga and Keuka both, though, have a really good representation in the wine industry. So if you come to our area and you're interested in wines, you're really going to love it. There's over 100 wineries in the Finger Lakes alone. There's a slew of wonderful restaurants. We have events in the season every single weekend. So pretty much from the beginning of June through October, there is something to do in the Finger Lakes every single day, every single evening, every single weekend. So it's a great place to come. It's affordable. It's the vistas are never ending. I don't know. I can't speak kindly enough about it.
Sold. I'm like pulling out my phone to book a ticket now.
Yeah, it's a great place to go. Watkins Glen specifically. We have Watkins Glen State Park, which is the second most visited park in New York State. It reminds me a bit of Lord of the Rings-esque type hiking through it. There's a series of falls and canyons through the park. It's amazing. There's a slew of wineries and breweries now on Seneca Lake. There's also Watkins Glen International Racetrack, which hosts NASCAR and things that I don't necessarily get into, but it brings a huge variety of people through the area. So it's a really fun place to go.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the things that's so interesting about New York State agriculture is, depending if you're on like the east side or the west side, where you are in the state, the regions are look really different, and there's lots of different types of production here. And I think, you know, if you look across the country, especially in the wine industry, different states have really kind of invested in supporting that in different ways. And I'm wondering, you know, what your sense is as how different it is to be a winemaker in New York versus, you know, Virginia or Missouri or California. Yeah. Like, what have they done for you lately?
Well, I mean, you know, I always look at wine regions by the varietals that they grow, and they're grown there for a reason. For example, in the Northeast, we grow cool climate loving grapes because that's essentially what we have. Our growing season's shorter than we would find in hotter climates. Virginia being a good example, they grow their predominant grapes, Viognier. They also have Norton, which is a more local variety that they're successful with. Neither grape can you do very well in the Finger Lakes, although Viognier is grown in the Finger Lakes. And then you look at California, that has a really long growing season. It's almost an unfair growing season for the rest of the world. So they grow a lot of hot climate grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon and, Zinfandel being prime examples. We stick to grapes that we can confidently grow and produce wines out of. Riesling is really king in the Finger Lakes. Chardonnay, Grüner Veltliner, I could go on and on, actually. And what we see as being a positive from that, and what the state and local tourism boards are doing for us, is they've accepted that and they've embraced it. So actually, yesterday was New York Drinks New York here in the city, and one of the main focuses was Riesling, which is exciting to see. There are an infinite amount of styles of Rieslings. A lot of people associate it with sweeter wines, but you can have a bone dry Riesling to a sickeningly sweet Riesling, whatever your palate prefers. And the Finger Lakes does a wonderful job producing all of them. So
I feel like that was the Riesling movement started a little bit by a wine bar called Terroir, where they do like a big focus on Riesling every year. And I always remember it because one of the things they do is they give these like, press on tattoos that are huge. So all of a sudden you're like walking around this and you're seeing all these people with like Riesling tattooed across like their arm or up their leg or around their shoulder. And I'm like, what's going on?
Well, and the spectrum of styles in Riesling is so clear. And I know for me that it was one of the first wines that, and maybe it was just, I'm sure there was like an industry push, this was not a totally like organic thing, but like, you know, it was one of the first wines that I kind of like learned about wine through, because it does express itself in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair statement to make. The traditional thought behind people getting into wines is they find a sweet wine, they really like it, and as they start advancing their palate, they get into drier wines. I don't always necessarily agree with that. I think you're going to like what you like. There's no preconceived notion to being a sweet wine drinker or dry wine drinker, but that's the benefit of Riesling. And you have styles to basically accompany all palates, which is really nice. Unlike your drier Bordeaux varietals or your drier Burgundy varietals that really specifically appeal to a very finite market, which isn't a bad thing.
Right. It's just different.
It's just different.
I like Riesling's good for people like me, like the moody wine drinker, where I'm just like, depending on what's going on. So last week we had on an Italian olive oil producer, Lorenzo Caponetti, who is out doing an olive oil dinner here in the city. And one of the things that was really interesting chatting with him is his farm is set on the site of all these Etruscan ruins. And so we were really talking a lot about thinking about being a steward of the land. There's some actual features on his property that were built like 2,700 years ago that are still functioning as like water collecting devices and other things that are useful to the farm today. And I think that's one of the things that I find interesting about wine, too, from an agriculture perspective, is you're really tending to a super long-term crop. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, kind of the tension there of, you know, making decisions for this season versus making decisions for, like, the lifetime of your work, kind of stewarding that space?
You know, talking from a viticultural standpoint, when you're considering planting a site, you need to consider what the market is going to bear or what the market wants 5 years from now, not necessarily what you're planting now. And then you take that information or you make that guess, and then you also try and plant it to, you know, the soil type that you have, the microclimate that's there. You know, in the Northeast, you can have a 1 to 2 to even a 5 degree temperature shift within a couple hundred yards from each other. Little pockets, you know, that dip down, that's where cold weather settles. And you could plant a grape that is perfect for the soil type that can't take that cold temperature, and you've made a drastic mistake. So there's a lot of variables that come into play in the Finger Lakes for planting grapes specifically that may not be in other areas. But you're right about being a steward of the land and trying to plant something that will be there for a long term. You know, it's a massive investment to plant these vineyards in the first place. And you know, again, soil type takes into a large play. What the market wants from us is probably the main thing, to be honest with you.
Sure.
And then after that, you know, we try and keep our vineyards going through some pretty non-invasive methods. We specifically at Lakewood compost all of our own grape leaves, so all of the sediment that we produce during harvest, we compost and blow back out in the vineyards. We roll out straw for compost as well. At the winery specifically, we also use solar to a large degree. About 90% of our production needs are met by solar. And we were one of the first wineries actually in the Finger Lakes to do that, although now in the Finger Lakes, a large majority of the wineries are switching to solar, so it's nice to see.
Yeah. What do you think, like, what are kind of the threats to the industry in that region? I mean, what are the things that are kind of keeping you up at night?
You know, we produce a really large variety of wines and high quality wines that we have to, you know, recoup at a certain price point.
Right.
And on the global market, when we're trying to compete on the global market, we're not always at the same price point as other nations bringing in wines that maybe, you know, propped up by a government or something of that nature. So at that, you know, we're at a disadvantage in that arena sometimes, although I think wine quality ultimately wins out. Not that they're producing a poor quality wine.
No, but people kind of take, you know, you taste what's in the glass and they'll make a decision there.
Right. I would say the other main thing for us right now is just so that we don't get oversaturated as a market. You know, as I said a little while ago, we have over 100 wineries in the Finger Lakes. We want to make sure that when folks come to visit us, that they get the vistas that I was talking about, and they don't see winery after winery or, you know, building after building.
Because
that's, you know, you're coming from a place like that and trying to get away from it. So we're aware of that, and we don't want to see that change too much.
Really looking at kind of the land conservation and scenic, like that kind of work. Is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, I do. That and sustainable development, you know, mm-hmm. trying to be more aware of what goes where in the area as a whole. So, but ultimately, not too much keeps me awake about our industry. I'm excited about our industry, and I think we're on a really nice upward trend. I think people are excited to come to the Finger Lakes. They're excited to try the wines. I don't think I've ever met an angry, upset person in my industry in the Finger Lakes. Everybody's in a great mood all the time, and that speaks volumes, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a great place to be.
That's the other thing I feel like, you know, people who work in the wine industry, when you think about professional development, and what that you're like, I gotta go, you know, take some trips to other places and taste some wine and like hang out. And wondering, like, how do you stay kind of up on, you said, you know, one of the things you have to do is kind of predict the market. Like, what are the tools for kind of keeping your finger on the pulse of like what people are drinking? Like, where are you looking for that type of information without giving it away?
You know, truth be told, I think the large majority of that information comes from the clients that come in our front door.
Yeah.
You know, we at Lakewood specifically can see up to 1,200 people on a Saturday in our tasting room, and they all want to share information. They all want to learn from us, but we also want to learn from them. It's a great give and take there. So when somebody says, I'm really into Sauvignon Blanc 80,000 times, you have an idea of what what maybe the market is bearing.
You're like,
but,
oh, maybe I should pay attention here. Yeah.
Right. You know, Cornell is right in our backyard there in Ithaca, and they've done an excellent job working with the wine industry in the Finger Lakes and helping us, guiding us in a direction that is successful for both Cornell and the wine region. So we get a lot of information from them. But ultimately, I would say the consumer that we see directs our attention more than anything else. So,
what about industry consumers? Where are you selling some of your wines, in restaurants or retailers?
Yeah, we have a pretty good market right now in New York State. We're in, I would dare say, over 50%, if not more, of the liquor stores in the state. A pretty large variety of restaurants as well. New York City is a market that we have some representation. If I may, Whole Foods, we're in Whole Foods and Astoria Wines and Spirits locally. But, you know, New York City is also a nut that's hard to crack for us, to be quite honest. There's a lot of places that we're trying to figure out where to go and what to do, and we're excited by that. We're excited to branch out further into this market. So, but upstate, we have a phenomenal representation. So,
yeah, I would have to imagine that people are there's a lot of people coming to New York to show their wines.
Yeah, very, very much so. And you know, I would guess being a Somm in New York City is a daunting task in that regard. I mean, a fun task, but daunting at the same time. So I understand where they're coming from. But again, you know, we feel like we're producing a not just Lakewood, but the Finger Lakes as a whole. We're producing world-class Rieslings. That's been proven.
Right.
And I think that the New York market is starting to pick up on that, as well as another grape called Lamberger, which is becoming very popular.
Lamberger,
another name for it's Blaufränkisch. It's an Austrian varietal that grows very well in the Finger Lakes. It's becoming very popular. So
you heard it here.
Yeah.
You heard it here first on the Farm Report.
That's right. Flint Corn and Lamberger.
That's right. It's a great combo.
Title of today's show.
Get it while it's hot. Or like nicely chilled.
Yeah. Or yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 62 degrees.
A little light chill on that. Yeah.
Yeah, just a touch. Chill the Riesling, though. You'll like it much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chad. This was great. And so excited to learn more about Lakewood Vineyards. And is there anywhere people can find out more about your business?
Yeah, we have a website. Just, you know, type in Lakewood Vineyards into the, you know, good old Google, and it'll take you right to us. Just for everyone's reference, we're open 7 days a week, almost year round, and we're always excited to see you come through our door. So we'd love to have you, and the Finger Lakes would love to have you as well. So,
oh, well, there we go. What a wonderful invitation.
Thanks for everyone's time.
Guys, you made it through another episode of the Farm Report. Charlie and I batting 0-2 with the smooth transitions,
yes.
But we're going to take you out on a high note. Big thanks for everyone out there listening. This show, of course, like all 34 of our weekly programs, is available for free. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you like to get your podcasts. The Heritage Radio Network crew is down in Charleston this past weekend doing a lot of live recording from the Wine and Food Festival down there. So check out some of those if you want to get a little bit of inside intel on what was happening in Charleston and the southern region. Look for those. And you can never miss exciting opportunities like that by signing up for the newsletter. Just visit the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org, and while you're there, click that beating heart, toss us a couple bucks. We are completely funded by the support of listeners like you and our great underwriters, like Whole Foods, where you can get some delicious New York State wine. And of course, a big thank you to Bob's Red Mill, our new flagship sponsor. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.